If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 122. We have subtitled this one Space Cadets because today we're going to talk about one of my favorite things in the world, which is Apple computers and Star Trek. So we're going to talk about space and all the things going on in space. With me today, because I'm Chris, is Matt.
Hello.
And Thomas.
Hello.
And we really have three things we're going to discuss about space today. One is, and probably the one that I think is most interesting, is
Falcon 9 rocket launch.
Well, it's not just the Falcon 9 rocket launch, but it's the fact that Elon Musk and his company have effectively done something great for the space industry, which is through competition, they're driving down the costs of space travel. And so that should in turn drive more innovation in a lot of related industries. So like payload, you know, we Richard Branson has talked about, you know, and I guess he is selling tickets already today, so people can take a ride into space, get outside of the atmosphere. Now, only they're going anywhere, they're just taking a ride, like getting in a prop airplane and, you know, flying over your house type thing. But still, that's exciting because that's the beginnings of where airlines came from.
Well, the other fact of that is that it actually benefits NASA, too, because it brings down the price for them as well.
Well, correct, since, you know, NASA has been forced to actually be a little bit responsible with all their money. You know, they're now contracting with SpaceX, and they're contracting with other companies for launches to put payloads in orbit, which makes perfect sense to me because, you know, although they are the space is part of their mission, we know that they don't manage it well because when they killed the shuttle program, they didn't have anything ready to go, which is shocking to me, at least from a planning standpoint.
That's pretty piss-poor planning on their part. It really is.
It is. And that's why NASA, the director of NASA is actually still an interim director, and they haven't named any real successor to that agency. But, you know, and working with NASA in the past, I do know of other programs that they do, like a lot of their ISS missions drive a lot of data. So in essence, there's a whole video side of the ISS, and then there's also an analytical diagnostic side for the maintenance of ISS. And so those are two secondary places, you know, or related industry that benefit because of the International Space Station, you know, and, you know, looking at the Falcon 9 rocket development, you know, it's made it's essentially made it 50% less to put a satellite in orbit. Now, did SpaceX have an issue in their last launch? Yeah, they had an issue. But one out of how many have they done?
That aside, though, look at NASA's track record with that sort of thing.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Too. You know, it's not I don't know how many they've done at this point, but I'm sure their percentage of loss, their loss rate has got to be.
It has
less
to be.
than NASA's.
Yeah. Well, the same with the Russian rockets. It's a lot less. They've had a lot of, you know, failure to launch issues where their astronauts and payloads were, you know, spread across the Russian landscape. You know, so, it's exciting because there's all these things, you know, growing up in the late 70s and 80s and early 90s, you know, a lot of science fiction and even science books about space talked about these concepts, you know, and some of them we still talk about today, like the mission to Mars and all of that, and that's pretty exciting, but that's still more of it's not intangible. I can't go and see a mission to Mars, you know. But spaceports, seeing rocket launches, that's becoming much more readily available to go see. And eventually, it'll be like the airline. You know, you won't think anything of it because it's so commonplace that, at the spaceport, there'll be a rocket launch. You know, but there are other things also that kind of curiosity is as this cost of putting payloads into orbit is so much more dramatically reduced, does that mean, you know, that we're going to also see a increase or at least another boom of technological advance wrapped around not just putting the payloads into space, but the payloads themselves, because now we can do so much more, or we can put so much more in space that's useful. You know, because most of the early satellites, like Sputnik, you know, it was cool that the Russians put it in space, but it basically was a beacon. You know, it broadcast a pulse of energy that could be tracked, but it didn't do anything. It didn't have any scientific instruments. It didn't extend the internet around the world. It didn't provide GPS. You know, what are those other functions that might happen?
On the other hand, you can't have the developments in satellite technology without Sputnik having gone up first.
Absolutely, but...
But your point is still valid.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's... We have to understand the value of the first step as we look at the development down the road.
But what I'm really talking about is, you know, we went from... When was Sputnik put into space? In the 50s, late 50s. So you go from the late 50s to about year 2000. And, you know, so there's what, a 40-some-odd year gap. And we did, I mean, there was a lot of technology that was built and expanded. We got GPS during those times. You know, we got satellite cellular service, satellite data services, you know. But most of that was so expensive and so... that it wasn't pervasively used. You know, it's satellite data services were used by the military to go from ship to shore and, you know, things like that where millions of dollars of taxpayer money could support that. But now with the cost of satellites getting, not only the size and capability of a satellite getting smaller, and then the cost of putting those payloads into orbit getting so much less or cheaper, you know, are we going to start seeing some of the benefits of not only technology we already have, but that technology will drive improvements at a much more rapid space. So in the next 40 or 50 years, that gap might be 10x what it was from the late 50s to 2000, as far as space-based technology goes.
Okay, yeah, no.
So I think it's exciting. You know, what are the possibilities? What can people do? What kind of scientific data are we going to gather from that? Because... now we can put so many more sensors in space.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I guess my
I see a lot of potential... Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I see a lot of potential benefit of this, actually. I see a lot of... We could actually have improvements for, like, cable cutters. I mean, over-the-air television, that's one of the go-tos for, like, cable cutters outside of, like, internet streaming. If we have satellites in space that will transmit over-the-air television from a satellite from another state on Earth to all states back down... literally from orbit, that would actually be something kind of an innovation for that, you know, for a example. It's just an arbitrary example.
Well, I'm thinking of it more as, you know, we talk about, like, one of the things that I do know is going on in the and what stopped them was just they couldn't get enough satellites in their cluster, you know, or I forget what, there's a term for a cluster of satellites in space. But, you know, Sirius Radio, or XM Radio, Sirius XM is a good example, is, you know, it's satellite radio. So they have satellites, they broadcast to the satellite from a ground station, and then those satellites broadcast to all the subscribers. But what would be even more useful to me is data services and cellular telephones. So right now, a cellular... handset is expensive because there's a premium on how many satellites are in space. to be able to provide that service. So if you want one, you're going to pay through the nose for it because it's it. You know, there's limited availability. You know, and so you look at the laws of economics. Well, if we can expand that limited availability, where it drives the price down, then maybe we aren't putting cell towers everywhere anymore, and we get better cell coverage because we're, you know, our handsets are now talking to a satellite.
Well, mobiles rather than cellular.
Well, correct. Yeah, mobile. Your mobile handset. Well, your smartphone, and then data services too. You know, so you know maybe we no longer need to have a cable modem sitting in our house. Because we can have either a box that does that, or all of our devices, laptops, tablets, desktops, your mobile, you know, all can access that cellular data network over the air. Because if you think about that, that changes the environment quite a bit too, because now we're not setting aside space and to build towers and then build their substations and their backup power units and everything else.
Well,
and then
there are
also
available that wouldn't need to be built or
exactly
maintained.
Exactly, and it would not necessarily be affected by weather.
Yeah, then there's that.
You know, that's one of the advantages of GPS, is that it is not affected by weather as we see it today. So, I mean, I think it's crazy what could be, you know, put out there. But on the dark side, though, you know, how much of that could be
perverted into a dreadful weapon?
Yeah, or not even a dreadful weapon, but, you know, we complain about surveillance states today, how much that could be, you know, how many more satellites to do surveillance, not just on enemies of our state, but our, you know, us as an enemy to another state, or our own state, you know, looking at
essentially citizens without warrants, like how the NSA is already doing that right now, possibly to us while recording this podcast.
Yeah, I'd like to think that, but there's so much data, and unfortunately, we're not even a speck of dirt.
Well, we haven't mentioned enough of the key words.
Yeah, dark web, NSA.
Give us a minute. We'll get them all.
Yeah. Well, we need to make them. We need to put them in as hashtags.
Yes.
You know that way.
That will work.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the other real possibility, too. You know, one of the downsides of this technology I see is, so, you know, we talk about Dayton and the traffic cameras. And I don't even get the appeal of it because...
Well, the appeal of it is it
well, I know
in
what,
money.
Exactly.
Not revenue for the city,
well,
which is...
No. I'm talking about... You know, the fact that, yes, it raises money and revenue for the city, but on the flip side of it, the fact that the Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP, yeah, the NCAA, NAACP, and, you know, and other, groups for liberty are suing, you know, I mean, think about it. Those groups... as a group, at least, are as powerful as certain individuals who have a lot of wealth. And they can, you know, whether it's frivolous or not, and whether they can change legislation, and they can certainly make the city hurt by tying up a lot of their resources in litigation. And, you know, it's so little gain for what they're getting.
Plus... Well, at least in this case, the city is essentially risking state funding.
Yeah.
To which then you have to weigh the risk and reward.
Word fair, yeah.
But
taking that the next step further, well, we don't have traffic cameras in the city anymore, but we have a traffic satellite. You know,
well,
with artificial intelligence systems getting better and better.
But what that does is it eliminates the argument that the NAACP is making.
Yeah.
The argument they're making is that the placement of the cameras in the city of Dayton affect the least fortunate amongst us.
Yes.
and unfairly so. And if you look at where those cameras are placed, it's a pretty good argument.
Oh, it is, absolutely.
And you could conceivably ask if that wasn't done on purpose.
Yeah.
Because face it, who's gonna fight that?
Exactly.
They really aren't. They don't have the resources to fight it. Unless an NAACP comes in, an ACLU.
You, yeah.
Chris Finney is the attorney. He is the attorney for Coast in Cincinnati, which is the Coalition Against Additional Spending and Taxation. It's a center-right, quasi-far-right organization, depending upon who you talk to. He's the lawyer taking the lead against the cameras in Dayton.
Yeah.
That speaks volumes to me, because this is the one issue that's got left and right alike joining forces.
But, you know, I also look at it this way. There used to be laws in the book, and I'm fairly certain they're still there, that require that if you are convicted of an infraction, that it has to be delivered by a sapient being, which a camera is not.
So the
but you,
there's a review process supposedly, yeah, that's happening in Dayton. Now I don't know about, I think it's Toledo, is the other Ohio city that's pushing the camera issue, but in Dayton there is a review process before the citation is issued. I think that the question that Mr. Finney brought up, if I'm remembering this reporting accurately, is how refined is the involvement of the officer in the actual review process, or is it a mere formality?
But is it also the other thing? Yeah, that we're putting these cameras in because we're, and this goes along with why the NAACP might be involved, or why they're involved. It's not really to track traffic patterns. That's a happy coincidence, and also a happy happenstance that they have another revenue stream that they don't have to actually do anything to get. But what they're really doing is they're surveilling an area because they believe that, you know, that you're guilty before proven innocent.
Well, and again, that's...
And that's the way I would look at it, if, you know, from a satellite perspective, too, is, you know, what other data would you be gathering, or could you potentially gather, or use even looking at cars, what you're looking at? You know, so before the podcast started, I was talking about an article that we're going to talk about in a future podcast about self-driving vehicles, but this is kind of corollary to that. In that article from Popular Science, they were comparing Bonnie and Clyde and how the freedom of using a driver vehicle allowed them to do what they did in the time period. And that, you know, that's kind of ridiculous today, because, you know, you look at, and they even bring this up, they use OJ as an example, but, you know, there's a high speed chase in California almost every day. And it's not like those cars. I mean, the stupid news helicopters follow them for hours on television, you know. And same thing with, I guess OJ was the first one that I really remember them doing that with, where you had a high speed car chase, but the police weren't really chasing. They were really following in a helicopter, and they knew exactly where he was and how they'd get their people there and all of that. And, you know, how that goes away. Well, you know, if you really think about that, so yeah, that's great. They're able to follow somebody who's done something illegal, demonstrably illegal. But at the time, he was just you didn't know. He was actually, at the time when they did that, he was just being investigated for.
He was a person of interest.
Yeah, in his ex-wife's death, and but you take that to the next level where I have satellites in space that can track all of that. What else can I track with it? And, you know, because it's tertiary data. So you even look at those videos, and it was just a couple weeks ago, they had another high-speed chase in L.A. where the news helicopter was following the whole time. Because they rebroadcast it on Channel 5 out of Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, I mean, if you scrub that video, you could tell what other cars were there on the highway. You could probably get most of their license plates. You know, there's all this tertiary information, you know, that because they were following, they might not necessarily need to get or be allowed by law to possess. You know, and that's kind of the whole thing about big data analytics is, you know, we're looking for patterns. So I put an algorithm in that does analytics, and I look for all the tertiary data and, you know, in a big stack of data, and then all of a sudden I find a pattern, and I can follow that pattern and go, oh, you know, like, say, during that high-speed chase, all the cars coming in off the off-ramps were from a certain gang, or they're registered to known gang members, or, you know, in the case of protesters, oh, we know that these people are going to someplace to...
So now, don't you foresee law enforcement using this technology to, one, find a witness to a crime and then compel them to testify?
Correct. So it becomes Minority Report.
Right, exactly. That's what I was going
for. Exactly.
In the opening with the like holographic cereal box where the mascots are singing and he just throws the box across the room because it doesn't shut up.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's that concept that, you know, we're doing predictive analysis to determine if you're going to break the law.
Right.
And then we're going to convict you before you've ever done it.
Well, I mean, that's the final extension, I think. And,
yeah.
And there's a level of sci-fi involved there that I do find a little crazy, but
yeah.
I think if it's within the realm of possibility that the technology could be developed to that direction, there will be a push to use it.
Oh yeah, well it was kind of interesting. So another, just to relate to another television show, so I was watching an episode of Bull, because I like Michael Weatherly, and he was trying to defend a friend who had been wrongly convicted of a murder 14 years before, who was trying to get out of, so they brought his case back to court, and they found out that exactly that it. And I mean, these guys, the television, they do a lot of research to make these shows believable. And it's very true that detectives, in many cases, they compel people to, you know, they essentially perform torture in order to get people to say what they want them to say. You know, because their job, in their mind, their job is, I need to do anything I can to force a confession or self-incrimination, or to coerce somebody to testify against them.
So then throw in, I had read an article somewhere, and I don't remember where, that had cited that the entire science of forensics as practiced by the FBI is now suspect.
Honestly, I think it should be suspect.
That's very true. It probably is. You know.
So you throw all those things together.
So there was a 60 Minutes from last year, I think. It might have even been the year before. So maybe in 2016, there was a 60 Minutes. And they talked about, well, now with the advent of DNA testing, they're finding that all these guys that were convicted for rape and murder and all this that are on death row, and have spent 30 and 40 years of their lives in prison, were not even the right suspect. You know, they just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And, you know, and I mean, think about the cost. Because now we have to pardon them, and you have to expunge their record. And then you have to compensate them for all of that time that, you know. So it becomes millions and millions and millions of dollars. Not only the millions of dollars we spent incarcerating them in the first place.
Agreed.
But, you know, it's almost a game. It's like, I need to show, because for me to be important within the police department or the Bureau of Investigation, I need to show that I can
close cases
and make get convictions.
Well, and that's not just law enforcement. That's then you're talking about the prosecutor's office. And
oh, the DA's office. Yeah.
The whole justice system. I like to think that it works, but there's enough evidence that it doesn't.
Yeah. Okay, let's swing this back around since we got off on my dark side tangent. So we kind of touched on this, you know, with the whole mission to Mars and all of that. There is some – it's pretty cool that we're seriously considering doing this at this point. It's also cool that the Curiosity rover is – lasted as long as it has. I mean, they even managed to fix something remotely so that it can now drill for core samples again. But what's more amazing is, you know, all the stuff that Curiosity has transmitted back, we now know the density of the air. And so now they're talking about not just having ground rovers, but now they've developed a flying helicopter rover that will go with the Mars mission. And the blades have to spin at like 10,000 RPMs or something ridiculous on this device, because Earth's atmosphere is so thick, a helicopter can be put in the air and it only has to spin, 700 or 800 RPMs a minute to provide lift, you know, and then a heavy helicopter is, 1,000 to 1,200. This is like 10x, you know. But because the atmosphere is so thin, but they've, you know, that's some of the data that they've gotten back. And so we've seen technological improvements.
So relating this back to our last topic, this is one of those developments that we will eventually be able to see in drone technology that's earthbound.
Correct.
As well as helicopter development.
Correct. Too. Correct.
So that's another one of those things that we look at our space program as, oh, whoop-de-doo, we send a man to the moon.
Correct, but we don't look at that.
But look at all the commercial development that came out of that in like the 20, 30 years after that.
Well, you had Tang, you know,
ballpoint pens.
Ballpoint pens, exactly. Lord, there's a ton of stuff.
Well, and computer technology itself.
Oh, absolutely.
Well,
you look at what was in the space shuttle. I mean, even the last one that flew, which, I mean, in relative terms, was not that many years ago, but it was not even the equivalent of, you know, the 8086 PCs or a Mac 128 when they came out in 1984, you know? And, you know, and you look at the ISS today, and the astronauts do all their scientific computing on laptops because they can ship laptops up that have a lot of power. But the systems that they built into the ISS, you know, it's not like the central computer system like we see on Star Trek and in Star Wars, you know, the hyperdrive computer and those types of things. So it's interesting to you know, where is that going to go, you know? You know, the other thing that I think is exciting about space the other thing is, space is a good example of digital transformation. That, you know, the idea that computers are so integral to what all the things that are done, that it's not, you know, IT is not a separate thing. IT is all of it. It's involved in every last bit of it. You know, either through control systems, design, you name it. You know, you have to have computational power and computational units to be able to do all of that. But you take it to the next step, you know, we talk about putting satellites in orbit. Eventually they're going to be able to do zero-G manufacturing. And so things we can't do in a gravity well on Earth or on Mars or wherever, we will now be able to do in space. You know, so there's a likely we'll get even smaller, more efficient, more power efficient, but more powerful chips. You know, so we will extend Moore's Law in the next level.
But what I find interesting is the concept of building things in space that we can't build on Earth. Now, chips aside.
Well, I mean, chemicals and...
Right.
You know, I mean, And the other thing is this, and I really wish Sean had been here with us tonight, because I'm actually going to hit him up in a future show. Because Sean is a professor and he teaches at a local university, and he specializes in automation. And, you know, in space, people aren't going to want to, it's just not going to be possible to sustainably have lots of people living in space, at least in the near term. Maybe a couple hundred years, you know, as technology advances, you know, possible. But, you know, to get that manufacturing started, that's going to be an entirely automated industry.
Now, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I just read an article yesterday or today that said the, it was like the top 35 fields that are going away. And manufacturing textiles and plastics, metal, and that's just the four I can think of off the top of my head that were in it. A lot of the manufacturing base that we see on Earth right now is going to be gone in the next.
Well, as far as human occupated jobs,
yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, it's easier to it's all repetitive process. It's easier to have a machine that can do it than it is, you know.
So for me, the interesting thing is that okay, now that frees us up to pursue what exactly?
Well, you know, so here's the this is the cognitive disconnect with and I just read an article on this. Hold on a minute. Let me look it up here.
I threw you a curveball. I'm sorry.
Well, no. This is related, and that's why I wanted to. But basically, it was saying that. This one was by Axios, and it was an article about how cities are addressing the coming job apocalypse, and it's about automation. And so they what was interesting about this is they actually so I'm going to this is in the second paragraph of this article. It says what's happening in Indianapolis. About 338,000 people are at high risk of automation taking their jobs, according to a new report. In Phoenix, the number is 650,000. In both cases, that's 35% of the workforce. In northeastern Ohio, it's about 40,000 workers are at high risk. In all three places, local officials are attempting to take charge by identifying jobs most at risk, skills most likely to be in great future demand, and how to organize education and industry around a new economy. And that's exactly it. The cognitive disconnect we have is just because a job type is going away does not mean that there won't be other jobs in the future. But there's a gap, because a lot of times, like manufacturing, and in this case what they're talking about, a lot of these jobs, they said that as a group, restaurant workers, food service workers, waiters, cooks will lose most jobs, followed by retail salespeople and cashiers, because that's probably the easiest places for today, where you can immediately. What we were talking with your wife, and you know, she was saying, well, do your McDonald's have the kiosks?
Yeah.
And we knew that was coming when the whole
fight for 15.
Yeah, minimum wage thing went up. So those people are going to have to do something else. And the thing about automation is that it's going to open up a whole lot of jobs in maintaining that automation. The problem is there's going to be a gap during the period of time where people don't have the requisite skills to do the jobs, you know, and particularly in this case, these are mostly unskilled positions. You know, the exception would be a cook. There is skill in being a good cook at a restaurant, but not flipping burgers at McDonald's.
Well, yeah, no, and I think that's the point, though.
Yeah.
I don't think it's those fight for 15 jobs are the ones that are at risk.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And the reason why I think it's driving the innovation these people are demanding that they be replaced by machines.
Exactly.
Which doesn't help them in any way whatsoever.
It's the same thing that's happening in China, and why now India is looking to become the new China and Brazil, because they have large populations, labor that can be, you know, trained the way you want them, and low, essentially the standard of living is low enough that the wages are low compared to Western standards.
Right.
You know, and so that's originally why jobs went to China in manufacturing. But now China is becoming more westernized in that respect, and they're demanding higher wages and everything else. Well, it's not as cheap to do stuff in China. And then there's the whole regulatory issues with Chinese manufacturing anyway. So,
but the point there is that the job develops, as the jobs develop there,
yeah,
the people become developed, become more aware of,
yeah,
in their, as their standard of living increases and all of that, they ultimately are going to push themselves out of the realm of what's now cheap and affordable labor.
Correct, correct. Well, particularly today when the problem with the labor forces today as compared to the labor forces in the past, prior to 1970, if you bought something that was made in America, it was probably extremely well done. Today, you buy something that's made in China, unless it comes from somebody like Apple or Google, or, you know, who because they want to sell their product at a premium and they want to make sure it is, you know, considered high quality, like a Rolls Royce. It's disposable. Everybody knows it's a junk, you know, and that's 90% of consumer electronics. You know, go to Walmart. You can buy a laptop, a Windows laptop, for $130. You can use it for 6 months, throw it away, and not feel bad, and go get the next one, which might be a little bit better, and it'll at least be faster, you know. But that's the concept. You know, it's just disposable. There's no quality involved, so things don't last. It's considered disposable, and so now we've got this whole disposable society, because everything in Walmart is disposable, pretty much. I mean, there are TVs and stuff that you might get a few years of use out of. But, I mean, even the fashion that they sell at Walmart and Target, it's considered... I mean, there's a whole category in retail. It's called disposable fashion, because... And that's why they have so many what they call turns of inventory, meaning that they rotate, you know... Those turns of inventory are what determines what kind of store you are.
Yeah.
According to the American Retailers Association. If you only have two turns a year, you're a Macy's. You're a big department store. You have six or more turns a year, you're what they call a discount store, which is a Walmart or a Target or a Myers. You know, and because the whole idea is you're going to buy this cheaply made clothing and other items, and you're going to use them for 2 or 3 months, and then you're going to throw them away. You know,
there's an element there that you're not talking about, and that's the marketing.
That too.
You know, the Targets of the world are in the same category as your Walmarts.
Mm-hmm.
The difference there is the marketing, so that people.
Well, it seems that Target is a more prestigious brand,
right,
to go shop at,
which is. You know, which brings you back to the whole...
Well, it's kind of funny. So, back, Lord, it's been 15 years since we took our first cruise. 15 or 16 years. And Molly and I, it was a bonus through the job I had. So we got to take a cruise. It was a good deal. They gave me an extra week of vacation just to take the cruise on top of my already... You know, I didn't have to burn my existing vacation to do it. And so we went on a cruise, and we did the whole cruise thing. We went to dinner every night and dressed up, and you know, we had a great group of people who were at our table. It was the same group of people every night. Well, we were the youngest, and I cannot remember her name, but Stan and his wife. But Stan, they were multimillionaires. They were a hell of a lot of fun to be around. But they... he made his money is he owned the manufacturing companies in China that manufactured all the clothes for Kmart, Walmart, and Target. And guess what? All their clothes come out of the same frickin' factories.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, life is bread and circuses and a game of mirrors.
But the other thing to piggyback off of that point is consumer electronics are done exactly
the
same way.
If you buy a pair of Beats headphones versus a pair of, you know, Koss headphones, they're all manufactured in the same plant. Now, Beats might use a better driver in their headphone, and I mean, we can argue that because I know a lot about headphones because I'm a musician. But fundamentally, you know, one set of earbuds from Koss and the ones from Sony are made by the same guys, and they're manufactured and packaged in the same plants with different, you know, logos on them. But the Sony's are $15 and the Koss cost you $3.99. Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. That's why I say the majority of consumer electronics are that way. You know, your Apple computer equipment, your Google equipment, your high-end computing systems like Alienware what is HP? They bought a company and they have a high-end. Those aren't made.
They bought Republic of Gamers or something.
Yeah,
like
something
that.
Like that, ROG. Those are designed as premium products and they're not being, they may use some of the same components as these other, but they're not manufactured in the same lines. But that being said, you know, the $100 and $200 and $300 laptops and desktops that you can buy at Walmart from HP and Dell and Acer and Asus and all that, they're all manufactured in the same plants, frankly. I mean, even you could even go so far as, you know, Apple and Google, their products are manufactured in the same plants that those other products are manufactured. They're just on different assembly lines. You know, there's only so many computer companies but manufacturers who manufacture logic boards and the integrated chips and all of that stuff. You know, Quanta and is one of the big names. They have been for years. And it's funny because there are big companies who sell Quanta computers but with their faceplate and everything on it. And you can go buy the same one from Quanta and it'll be a third of the cost, you know. But you're absolutely right. Well, it goes back to, what was the movie with Bruce Armageddon?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bruce Willis. And so the Russian, they get the cosmonaut on the space shuttle and they couldn't get the shuttle to launch off the asteroid. And, you know, he goes in there and the one astronaut goes, "What the hell are you doing? This is," and he goes, "It doesn't matter. It's all made in the same place, Taiwan, China." You know.
Exactly.
So, I think we've kind of beat that to death. That's like 45 minutes of talking on just space stuff. So, you have anything else you want to throw in? Maybe something totally off?
Well, is this the end of the podcast?
We could talk for another 15 minutes. I try not to have our listeners, you know, hear us rave any longer than 60 minutes.
Yeah, they can pause it. They can, like, pause it, leave it, come back later. They can delete it from whatever part of their hard drive they have it stored on.
Did we actually hit all the topics that you
We
did?
Actually hit all the topics.
Wow, in 45 minutes?
In 45 minutes.
We've ever done that.
No, I don't think so either. Well, usually we go off on a tangent so deep that we can't ever get back, and so we never get, like, the last topic.
Well, let me
talk about some of the things that I am thinking about in future episodes.
Okay.
So one of the ones I want to talk about was we talked about the Bonnie and Clyde article that was in Popular Science, and they made some really, really good points about liberty and technology and how some of these technological advances are actually going to limit some of the liberty that we had in the past. Now, the Bonnie and Clyde article takes it that, you know, you're never going to see another Bonnie and Clyde because you know, with the advent of self-driving cars and the fact that, you know, we're going to be tracking these cars all the time to make sure that there's no collisions means that, you know, they can't just go wherever they want and, you know, and do what they were doing like they used to do.
See, now, I think you may be trusting the technology a little bit more.
No.
I think the next Bonnie and Clyde is going to be some, and I hate the word because we've talked about this before, some hacker that, you know.
Well, and they talk about that in the article, you know, that you know, the exception would be somebody who hacks the system so that they can't be tracked, which is totally possible. You give anybody access to a piece of hardware, they're going to get access to it.
But to be fair, that's not what the term hacker used to mean. Hacker used to actually refer to, like, actual, like, coders and stuff like that that weren't really...
Well, in this case, because it's a self-driving car and it has a computer and AI that controls it, it would be that case of hacker. Matt and I talked the last episode about the whole connotation of the word hacker, and today it's mainstream because, you know, we do life hacks, and I hacked this, you know, I hacked this clothespin into this beautiful picture hanger, and, you know.
Well, I mean, it's really, it's any system can be hacked.
Correct.
And that's, I think, the point. I mean, as we get to the point where the technology advances and advances and advances, your average person will either learn those skills and maintain their freedom, or they'll just trust the system to work.
But, you know, so that goes back to what we were saying before about certain people we interact with and everything. There are far more followers than there are leaders.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of funny because my youngest daughter made a very good point. And she goes, good leaders don't necessarily have to be morally good. And I totally agree with that. Because good leaders are typically the people who want to push the envelope, meaning that they're willing to break the rules to get what they need done. And that's why we have so... I think that's part of the thing why we a lot of these people aren't good leaders, but they are leaders in the sense of what they do. So we see a lot of politicians who are indicted on corruption charges and all this other stuff because they feel that the ends justify the means, whereas followers tend to have to, you know...
But the key there is that you get to the point where the ends justify the means because it's for the greater good, or at least in the perception of that politician,
correct,
or that individual, it's in the best interest of the greater good. The problem with that is that unless you have some sort of system of evaluating what is the greater good.
Well, that's right.
That system
greater good. Greater good is also is perceptive,
right,
or, you know, perception.
It is.
You know what that leader's perception, and we always praise the guys who manage to get it right, and the guys who get it wrong, we vilify. You know, welcome to history.
Plus, the other thing that I don't think we've really ever really talked about in this framework is continuous improvement. I think the way we think about things has to continually be looked at and evaluated.
Absolutely.
And as we make decisions, but, we come back and review
those
decisions.
But that's another skill I think good leaders do, is they ask a lot of questions. You know, they question authority. They question, why do we do things a certain way that we do them? You know, they question everything. I think that's why also you find leaders who become frustrated very easily,
yeah,
because they have this compulsion to question everything. I know I'm this way. You know, I can't stand, I mean, even at low levels, you know, why are we doing something that takes all this effort? And the answer is, well, it's because that's the way it's always been done, or it's the way corporate wants us to do it. And I'm like, but is that the best way?
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, people look at you sideways because, you know, followers dislike change. Now, I don't like change for change's sake, but I don't dislike change when change improves things.
Amen to that.
You know, and a lot of, particularly working in the corporate world and working with the government, a lot of change is made just for change's sake. You know, and I think that's something we can talk about more, particularly in relation to certain things that go on, and like the Bonnie and Clyde thing. The other thing I wanted to talk about is with why I said I wish Sean were here. I want to talk about this whole issue of automation with jobs, because this last article, which is, they pulled their information from the Bureau of Labor, is pretty good about where the government sees the jobs going away, and a lot of them are what I think are obvious. It's again the asking for $15 minimum wage just told particularly not, and it, that doesn't really help small businesses, but it helps the corporate businesses like McDonald's and Yum Foods and all these those jobs, those unskilled starter jobs that high schoolers typically filled are going to go away. I mean, they already have. Jack in the Box was one of the first ones, and they for years have been doing the kiosks at their, you know, on any shift, they might not have more than two or three actual human employees in a Jack in the Box. That's impressive if you think about it. I can pay those guys just a little bit more, but I'm not paying 10 people to be there all the time. And, you know, a store near and dear to my heart, like Tractor Supply Company, in their market, they're competing against another farm company who's becoming pervasive across the United States called Rural King. And Rural King had longer hours than they did. So now, therefore, they're being forced to, well, they still have longer hours, but they're being forced to expand their hours. But the economy of their profits and what their corporate says they should be making profit-wise, they are not expanding in personnel to man those hours. So now you're stretching people across, you know, all of these hours, you know, or so essentially you're having fewer employees in the store at the same time, you know, and that's to me, that's even though there's no automation, real automation involved, you're effectively getting the same result, which is fewer people, meaning I have to pay fewer people to expand my business. But the article is interesting in that there are lots of job categories that we wouldn't think about that have a 96 and 97% rate of cancellation, just like those fast food jobs. So, well, I think we'll wrap it up there. We want to hear from you. Please send us some feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com.
And don't forget to ostracize Senator Rob, what's his name?
Portman.
Don't forget to ostracize Senator Rob Portman for his recent decision on not supporting the bipartisan bill for net neutrality in favor of a bill that clearly is not even real and is really just to benefit ISPs. If you are a Ohio citizen that listens to our show, please, thank you.
And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
Bye.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.